Now, anyone who may have heard this series of lessons before has a unique opportunity, and that is that they may stay awake for the part that they slept through the last time. How was that? Okay, good. I can hear better myself. And I'll try to stay awake. Now, the title of our lesson series is I Will Remember the Land. Now, we are living in the year 1993 A.D. According to Usher's dates, the call of Abraham was in 1921 B.C. And thus, by simple arithmetic, we can determine that the nation of Israel, in one form or another, has existed for a period of 3,914 years, approximately. Now, I submit to you that in spite of the fact, and this is a pretty important concept because it applies to ourselves, that in spite of the fact that the nation of Israel throughout its entire history has run contrary to the moral requirements and the religious requirements of God, it has nevertheless served the purpose of God perfectly throughout all this period. Or in other words, that which the Lord has wished to accomplish with the nation of Israel, whether in obedience or disobedience, He has accomplished. And the same was true with ourselves, brothers and sisters. We can play the part of a Moses, or we can play the part of a Pharaoh. We can't get out of playing a part in the plan of God. There is no neutral position. So why not play the part of a Moses? There's much more to be gained. If we consider that from the creation to the second coming of Christ to be a period of approximately 6,000 years, the Jews have served in a witnessing function for approximately two-thirds of that period. Now, the history of Israel may be divided into five major periods. The first period of 215 years may be termed the patriarchal period, and it runs from the call of Abraham to the relocation of Jacob and his family in Egypt. Three major developments occurred during this period. The first one was the selection of Abraham and his natural seed as a special people for the service of the Lord. The second one was the making of the everlasting covenant, whereby both Jew and Gentile could obtain the hope of eternal salvation. And the third one was through the births of Ammon, Moab, Ishmael, and Esau were established the Arab peoples with whom Israel has contended throughout his history. Bobby Henderson has touched on this morning. We're going to touch on it also this morning because it not only is it important, it is also current. And Israel will continue to contend with these peoples until the return of our Lord. As long as Israel continues in disobedience to the Lord, this contention continued. And you will recall that the same year that Israel left Egypt, she was confronted by the Amalekites, as Brother Henderson pointed out. Now that was when the arms of Moses were held up by Aaron and Hur in order to sustain the victory. The Amalekites were the descendants of Esau, and this battle between Amalek and Israel was symbolic of conditions which would prevail in the future. Now, Brother Henderson extended this parallel in a spiritual sense, having to do with ourselves, but it is also maybe taken in a literal sense with the contention between Israel and Amalek, or the Arab peoples. When the battle was over, the Lord made a special pronouncement which Moses recorded, and that is in Exodus chapter 17, verses 14 to 16. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And that, of course, is how it has been. In addition to direct wars that Israel has had with the descendants of Esau, it is interesting to note, also, as Brother Henderson pointed out, this is a strange parallel we're running here, that Haman, who attempted to arrange the genocide of the Jews at the time of Queen Esther, was also an Agagite who is an Amalekite. Herod, who ruled Judea at the time of the birth of Christ, and who ordered the slaying of the Jewish children, was an Idumean who was a descendant of Esau, and as Agag also was. The perpetual enmity was then initiated in the patriarchal period. It started right from the very beginning, and it will carry on until Christ returns. The second period in Israel's history may be termed the period of nation building. It was a 255-year period, starting with the moving of the Hebrews into Egypt and ending with the crossing of the Jordan into the Promised Land. Now, this period falls into three natural divisions. The first division was an era of prosperity for the Hebrews in Egypt. It was a 133-year period from the time of Jacob and his family moved into Egypt until the Great Oppression. During this period, Israel grew and multiplied and lived in the richest section of the land of Egypt, the land of Goshen, and they lived there under the protection of Joseph for about a half of this period. And then Joseph died. Exodus 1 verse 7 states, and the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. When Jacob came into Egypt, he brought with him 69 relations, along with himself and Joseph, making a total of 71 souls. When Israel left Egypt, although we do not know the exact number, it would appear that the nation had grown to at least 2 million people, exclusive of the mixed multitude that accompanied Israel out of the land of Egypt. The second division of this nation-building period was the Great Oppression, which lasted 82 years. Sometimes we mistakenly think that this oppression in Egypt lasted for hundreds of years. It didn't. It lasted for approximately 82 years. And one might expect that under severe conditions such as these, these conditions may have inhibited population growth. But actually, the reverse was true. Exodus chapter 1, verse 12 states, but the more they afflicted them, that is, the more the Egyptians afflicted the Israelites, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Even Pharaoh attempted to destroy the newborn males, but he was not very successful. Exodus 1:17 tells us, but the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. The third division was the period of 40 years from the time of the Exodus until the time of the crossing of the Jordan and the entering into the Promised Land. During this period, four necessary things were accomplished. First of all, the old generation, heavily influenced by Egyptian idolatry, died off. You will recall that with the exception of Caleb and Joshua, everyone over the age of 20 years old when they left Egypt died in the wilderness. Now, we would be wrong if we considered that all these people were sinful. They weren't. There would be many elderly people who left Egypt whose lifetime came to an end perhaps 4 or 5 years into the wilderness period. They certainly were not necessarily wicked people, although certainly some of them may have been. But nevertheless, the entire generation that left Egypt that were over the age of 20, with the exception of Caleb and Joshua, did not see the promised land. Now, two, the second point was that in addition to the children of Israel, there was also what was referred to as a mixed multitude who left Egypt with them. Now, these were people. They could have been Egyptians, they could have been others who had either been drawn to the God of the Hebrews, perhaps having witnessed the 10 plagues, and or perhaps by long association with the Hebrews because they were in Egypt quite a period of time. It may be that they desired to also to escape the hard life under the Pharaoh of the oppression. But they left Egypt along with the children of Israel. I should say perhaps that we must realize that when the 10 plagues in Egypt occurred, the land of Egypt was terribly devastated. Egypt was a ruined country. Pharaoh's servants virtually had to take him by the nape of the neck and shake him and say, "Don't you realize that Egypt is destroyed?" And of course, Pharaoh finally had to relent. Well, if a country is destroyed to that extent, employment possibilities decrease considerably. And this mixed multitude were maybe among many of those people who had no longer a way of livelihood. So they took their chances with the children of Israel. Exodus 12, verses 37 to 38 states, "And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 on foot that were men, besides children. And a mixed multitude went up also with them, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle." Now, during this wilderness wandering, the mixed multitude would be either completely converted to the God of Israel, or else they died in the wilderness along with the rebellious children of Israel themselves. It is interesting to note that Caleb was not a Hebrew, but rather a Kenizzite, and may have, there's no way of knowing for sure, may have been associated with this mixed multitude. But if this is the case, it only goes to prove that the opportunity for eternal salvation is extended to all mankind. It is not exclusively for the Jews. The mixed multitude, nevertheless, was a problem for Moses. In Numbers 11 and 4 records, "And the mixed multitude that was among them fell to lusting, and the children of Israel also wept again and said, Who shall give us flesh to eat?" Now, in any event, throughout the 40 years in the wilderness, the mixed multitude either died off or else they were absorbed into the 12 tribes. The third thing that was accomplished in the wilderness was that the 600,000 oppressed male slaves that left Egypt were transformed into a highly organized and well-disciplined army capable of conquering the land of Canaan. Now, this may be somewhat of an oversimplified statement, inasmuch as a great many of that 600,000 who left Egypt also died in the wilderness. But their children were the ones who became organized and disciplined into a well-qualified army to accomplish the purpose of God. It was of this army that the harlot Rahab saw and spoke about and said to the spies when they went into Jericho to spy out the land. Joshua 2 verses 9 to 11 says, and this is what Rahab said, and I'm always very impressed with this. I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, and that all of the inhabitants of land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you when ye came out of Egypt, and what ye did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side of Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God of heaven above and earth beneath. Now, isn't that a remarkable statement of faith? We have a comment in the 11th chapter of Hebrews on this very event, where in verse 30 it says, or rather 31, it says, by faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not when she received the spies with peace. Now, what do we mean that she perished not with them that believed not? This is referring to the destruction of Jericho. How could the people of Jericho believe? Nobody was doing any preaching. The city was completely walled about, and the inhabitants stayed in there. How could they believe? Well, Rahab believed, didn't she? Rahab recognized what I would call a logistical miracle. It was estimated that about 2 million people left Egypt. How many they were when they entered the Promised Land, there were some estimates have gone up as high as 3 million. The wilderness could not support 2 or 3 million people. And everybody knew that. The people in Jericho knew the wilderness couldn't support them, but they knew the children of Israel were there. This thing wasn't done in a corner. They would have to know that Israel needed clothing, food, water, guidance. They would probably find out that Israel was remarkably free from disease and from the hazards of the wilderness. Rahab alone recognized these facts and recognized that Israel could not survive except with the help and guidance and provision of the hand of God. Now, by virtue of the impression made upon Rahab by this mighty army and its exploits, along with her obvious knowledge of this logistical miracle that sustained Israel in the wilderness, and understanding the faith that was generated in her, saved her from destruction. And thus, Hebrews 11 and 31 records, by faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not when she received the spies with peace. Now, we, brothers and sisters, have lived and are living in a very, very similar period, because we recognize, many of us here have lived in the time of the formation of the State of Israel in 1948, and we, if we can recognize it, are looking at also a logistical miracle. that a nation of approximately 3 million people, surrounded by 80 million enemies, have been able to survive from 1948 until the present time in that land. This fact should cause some of the peoples of the nations of the world to ask the question, how could this be? And if they ask that question and if they obtain some answers, they also have an opportunity for eternal salvation. The fourth thing that was accomplished during the 40-year period was the giving and the practice of the law of Moses, along with the construction of the tabernacle. This schoolmaster, as termed by the Apostle Paul, was designed to bring Israel to Christ, as it were. And it continues to provide instruction to every generation of believers, enabling them to comprehend the love of God and eternal salvation that is available to them through His Son. That law, we use the law of Moses as a schoolmaster also to bring us unto Christ. Well, the third major division in the history of Israel is what I have termed the period of national independence. It was an 865-year period running from the entering into the Promised Land until the Babylonian captivity. Now, this period may be divided into three natural sections. The first of these sections is the period of the Judges, a duration of 356 years from the time of the crossing of the Jordan to the anointing of King Saul. During this time, Israel was governed by a succession of 16 judges, beginning with Othniel and ending with Samuel. And over this period in their history, Israel became well-schooled in the goodness and severity of God. Judges chapter 2, verse 7 states, "And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he had done, that he did for Israel." And then in going to verse 10, "And also all that the generation, and also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works of the Lord, which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam." Well, what does it mean that they knew not the Lord? They were certainly taught their past history. There was a great deal of evidence of God in their lives, yet it says that they knew not the Lord. Well, it simply means that they ignored all these things. They did not respond. They did not put their trust in God. We have already learned this week, I think it was Brother Ernie Glass mentioned it, that these people were too interested in material gain to consider what the Lord wished them to do. Now, the sequence of punishment and deliverance which followed established a pattern of operation between God and Israel, which was to be characteristic of the divine policy throughout the entire history of the nation. And that policy was, when the nation sinned, God delivered them into the hands of their enemies. When they repented, God saved them by hand of a national leader. This happened time and time again throughout the period of the Judges. Each new generation had to learn the same lessons as their fathers. And we hope, brothers and sisters, that we don't have to do this, that we can learn and appreciate the lessons of the past and not have to repeat them. To get an appreciation of the duration of this period, if King Saul had been made king in 1992, that's last year, Israel would have crossed the Jordan in 1636. That sounds like a long time ago, doesn't it? There was a period of judges. It was a lengthy period. This 1636 was just 16 years after the landing of the Pilgrim Fathers. Because of Israel's continued stubbornness, the Lord did not quickly drive out the pagan peoples in the land. Some of them were still to be found there in the days of Solomon. And as a matter of fact, by the time of David and Solomon, part of the territories of Asher and Manasseh remained in the hands of the Phoenicians, and Israel never did conquer these areas. And while part of the land of Judah remained in the Philistines, and this section of the territory was never fully conquered, even in David's time. Now, nevertheless, these pagan peoples, the Philistines in particular, had a certain amount of fear for the God of Israel. Here, this is a strange phenomenon too, and there may be vestiges of it today. In the days of Samuel, the last of the judges, when the Ark of the Covenant was brought back into Israel, 1 Samuel 4, verses 5 to 8 declares, "And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, 'What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?' And they understood that the Ark of the Lord was come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, 'God is come into the camp.' And they have said, 'Woe unto us, for there hath not been such a thing heretofore. Woe unto us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness.'" The Philistines are saying this. This is a remarkable statement, brothers and sisters, because it is referring to an event that occurred 350 years previously. And this would lead me to believe that the history of the Exodus had been recorded by the Philistines and had been rehearsed with sufficient frequency to remain current in their minds. Now, this event to the Philistines was not just Hebrew folklore. The Philistines believed it. This fact was reinforced also in 1 Samuel chapter 6, verse 6, when after the Philistines captured the ark, which gave them no end of trouble, they decided to return it. And here we have a record of a debate among them. It says, "Wherefore then do ye harden your hearts?" This is the Philistines talking to one another. "Wherefore then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts when he, that is God, had wrought wonderfully among them? Did they not let the people go? And they departed." Thus we see that the hand of God and the superiority of the God of the Hebrews was known by the pagan peoples by virtue of the witness of his people Israel throughout this period. And the logical question is, well, why didn't they believe them then? Why did they keep contending with that nation when they could see that the God of the Hebrews was far superior to anything that they had? And there's just no answer to it. Now, the second division of the second division of the period of national independence was only 120 years long, but it was a very important period. This was the era when the change from judges to kings occurred. During this period, the everlasting covenant was proclaimed to David under the designation "The Sure Mercies of David." although that expression wasn't used at the time, that expression describes in a matter of a few words the everlasting covenant as it was given to David. This covenant gave David great assurance of the resurrection of the dead. In Psalm 71, we have David express his confidence in the hope of salvation, where he says in verses 19 and 20, "Thy righteousness also, O God, is very high, who hath done great things. O God, who is like unto thee? Thou which hast showed me great and sore troubles shall quicken me again and shall bring me up again from the depths of the earth." Well, nothing can be clearer than that statement. This was the era when under Solomon Israel enjoyed the admiration and the wealth of the Mediterranean world. Solomon's temple was constructed and it stood for over 400 years. That's a considerable length of time for a building, and it would have stood longer than that had it not been destroyed. 1 Kings chapter 10 verse 23 tells us, "So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom, and all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart." And then verse 27, "And the king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stones, and cedars made he as sycamore trees that are in the vale for abundance. But alas, this was also the era when Israel suffered a major setback. This setback was due to the folly of King Solomon himself, the wisest king on the earth at that time. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1 states, "But Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites." And then in verse 4, "For it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God as it was with the heart of David his father." Now, I won't turn it up now because the time is running along so fast, but if you'd like to make a note, Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 15 to 18, there is a commandment concerning Israel that when they had kings, that those kings were not to multiply wives unto themselves, neither were they to multiply horses unto themselves. Strange combination. Nevertheless, Saul, David, and Solomon completely ignored this writing. Maybe they had never seen it. It's hard to say. But they completely ignored it and didn't follow it. Solomon was responsible for leading the nation back into idolatry, an action so serious that it was remembered in the days of Nehemiah over 500 years later. Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 26 declares regarding the foreign marriages of the Jews, which were taking place at that time, he said, "Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin." The death of Solomon saw the kingdom divided, a condition which lasted over a span of 389 years, ending in the total captivity of the nation by Babylon. The northern kingdom, Israel, survived for 253 years, and the southern kingdom of Judah carried on for another 136 years before falling into captivity. In this divided kingdom era, many biblical prophets flourished. Zechariah, Amos, Micah, Isaiah, Hosea, Jonah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Habakkuk, and Nahum all prophesied during the divided period. Thus, in this era of history of Israel's history, was generated much of the prophetic information about the kingdom of God, which we have studied throughout all of our lives. In this era, we learn that the patience of God had an end, and that He will not always endure sin, the sin of man, even of His own people. Well, the fourth major period in the history of Israel began in 586 B.C., when the nation was led into captivity unto Babylon, ending in 70 A.D. Now, I realize that there was a return, etc., but the nation was never independent again, except for a very brief period, which I will mention. This was a lengthy period of 655 years, during which time the prophet Micah, in chapter 3, verse 6, was fulfilled. That would be about the year 397. The prophet Malachi, the last of the prophets, also wrote in this period, and he was the final one. And in Micah 3 and 6 it says, "Therefore night shall be unto you that ye shall not have a vision, and it shall be dark unto you that ye shall not divine, and the sun shall go down over the prophets, and the day shall be dark over them." That's quite a statement, isn't it? Very descriptive. The sun shall go down over the prophets. Just think of this great era of the prophets. The people thought they would be there forever. And God said the time would come when you will no longer hear one of those prophets speak. And over for a period of 400 years until the coming of Christ, there was no living prophet in Israel. Hosea lamented almost 200 years previously in chapter 6, verses 4 to 7, "O Ephraim, what shall I do unto thee? O Judah, what shall I do unto thee? For your goodness is as a morning cloud, and as the early dew it goeth away. Therefore I have hewed them by the prophets." There's another remarkable statement there. It's like a lumberman hewing a tree. The prophets hewed the nation to try to shape them up, as it were, but they were unsuccessful. "I have hewed them by the prophets. I have slain them with the words of my mouth. And thy judgments are as the light that goeth forth. For I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. But they, like men, have transgressed the covenant. They have dealt treacherously against me." The end had to come. But not only did the nation go into captivity, but the prophetic message was at last taken away. Now, although the nation returned to the land after 70 years of Babylonian captivity, that they did not return as a sovereign people, but were under the Persian domination until the Battle of Issus in 333 B.C., when Alexander the Great defeated the Persians and gained control of the empire. When Alexander came to Jerusalem, there was no battle. He was met by a company of priests who took him into the city and showed him in the book of Daniel where it had been prophesied that Greece would be the conqueror of the Persian Empire. Alexander was so impressed that he granted the Jews favor and protection throughout the conquered territories. From 166 B.C. to 66 B.C., a period of 103 years, was known as the Maccabean period. Because of religious oppression from the Grecian Jews under Mattathias, I want to get this straight. I'm racing against time here. Because of religious oppression by the Greeks, the Jews, under a leader, Mattathias, revolted, defeating the Syrian army, which was controlled by Greece, and restored temple worship. Over a 103-year period, Judea drew further and further away from Greek rule, and for a brief period of about 72 years, secured political independence. It was during the Maccabean period that a faction known as the Pharisees originated. Thus, this development took place in opposition to John Hyrcanus, a Maccabean ruler who attempted to introduce Greek ideas into Judaism. And it is a strange thing that although the Pharisees violently opposed Hellenism, it was this time that they embraced the doctrine of the immortality of the soul. Now, the Apostle Paul was a Pharisee, and therefore the Apostle Paul would have had to have believed in the immortality of the soul in his early days, and it would have been the instruction of Christ during his wilderness period that he was corrected in that point. On a positive note, it may be said that during this 655-year period of national subjugation, that idolatry was never again introduced into Israel, nor has it been since. In 63 BC, the Roman general Pompey conquered Jerusalem, bringing the nation under the control of the Roman Empire. 106 years later, in 70 AD, the Jews revolted. Jerusalem was destroyed, and the nation was scattered. The greatest event of this period in the national subjugation was the birth of Christ, his ministry, his death, his resurrection. In this period also, the 12 apostles were sent out, and by the time Israel as a country came to an end, Christianity had been well established throughout the Roman world. The fifth period, and we're virtually finished, the fifth period in the history of Israel was a period of 1,878 years from 70 AD until 1948 when the nation was reborn. This period may be termed the furnace of affliction. And although the Jews were renowned in this period in the fields of medicine and law, finance and politics and science, there always remained a separation between the Jewish community and the Gentile community. And although they enjoyed peace at times, they more often endured terrible persecution, the most awful of which, of course, was in our own era, the Holocaust, during World War II when 6 million Jews perished. The Balfour Declaration in 1917 provided a land for the people, and World War II from 1939 to 45 provided a people for the land. And thus, in 1948, the sovereign state of Israel was declared and recognized by the United Nations. We are now living in the sixth period of the history of Israel, a period which will see the return of Christ to the earth and the reestablishment of the kingdom of God. It is our prayer that we may all be accounted worthy to see that day. So I think we just made it.